I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. For 439 years, the Maryland General Assembly has convened annually to do the people's business. Yesterday was sine die, the final day of the 2019 session. Last night, legislative business ended about 30 minutes early so lawmakers could remember and pay tribute to Speaker Mike Bush, who passed away on Sunday. More than 2,400 bills were introduced. Today on Midday, what passed and what failed. In the win column, hourly workers will get a raise, styrofoam will vanish from restaurants, more clean energy will find its way to the market, and Johns Hopkins will get its private police force. Losing this year, an aid in dying bill and bonds for horse racing. Rachel Bay of WIPR, Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters, and Brian Sears of the Daily Record join me with a report from Annapolis when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for hanging with us. The 439th Maryland General Assembly is in the history books. Legislators conducted business during the long final day of the session yesterday while mourning the loss of Speaker of the House Mike Bush, who succumbed to pneumonia on Sunday afternoon. Lawmakers provided $800 million in increased funding for public schools, and they overrode Governor Larry Hogan's executive order that the school year must begin after Labor Day. They also overrode the governor's veto of the statewide minimum wage that will rise to $15 an hour over the next 5 years. They authorized a private police force for Johns Hopkins University, and they raised the age for buying tobacco products to 21. Today on Midday, a recap of what was accomplished and what bills failed to prevail in the General Assembly with Rachel Bay, who covers the State House for WIPR. Rachel, good to see you.
Good to see you.
And I appreciate your being here. You've got a terrible cold, and you're still hanging with us, so thank you very much for that. And Brian Sears, who writes about all things Annapolis for the Daily Record. Hey, Brian. Maybe we don't have Brian, but we'll look for Brian.
Hey, how are you, Tom? I'm here.
Okay, good, good, good. And Josh Kurtz, he's the founder and editor of Maryland Matters. Josh, do we have you? All right, we're getting Josh. We don't have him quite yet, but it's been a busy day yesterday, and it's a busy day still today. But listeners, if you have questions about what happened during this year's legislative session, give us a call at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle is @midday_WIPR. And I guess Josh Kurtz is, in fact, joining us, the co-editor and founder of, or the founder and co-founder, and editor of Maryland Matters. Josh, how you doing today?
Good, thanks. Sorry about that glitch there. Yeah,
no problem. So, Rachel, let me start with you. Yesterday was really an extraordinary day, a sine die, a final day, sort of unlike any other.
Yeah, it's something that, and I've only been covering the legislature for several years now, but people who have been around for a lot longer than I have said this was really a historic moment, something they've never seen before, where the speaker died the day before the General Assembly adjourned. And Michael Bush wasn't just the speaker, he was the speaker for 16 years, and his presence was felt in so many aspects of Maryland and Maryland politics, not just in the State House, but around the state. And so his loss was very heavily felt yesterday.
Yeah, and Josh Kurtz, you've hung around the State House for quite a while. What was your take on the mood in both chambers yesterday?
Well, it was really somber, sober, you know. Sine die is always a very frenetic day. A lot of bills move quickly, a lot of sort of backroom maneuvering. But there's kind of a lot of fun and parties and merriment, too. And, you know, this was just a totally different vibe, as Rachel said, unlike anything else. And, you know, there are a lot of powerful political figures around, but Speaker Bush was really beloved in his chamber, and you really felt the members sense a loss yesterday.
Yeah, and Brian Sears, it's interesting that Speaker Bush received a number of accolades and fond remembrances from people on the other side of the aisle as well. It wasn't just Democrats who rose to speak about Mr. Bush's integrity and other qualities.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that stands out from yesterday was Delegate Nick Kipke, who's the House Minority Leader, the top Republican, if you will, who spoke at length about his relationship and said that he had grown in his relationship with the Speaker in ways that hadn't he hadn't expected. And he told an amusing anecdote about how the speaker had once coached a football team against his father, who had played, and his father ended up scoring a winning touchdown. And later on, he said, I thought that would really help me. And then, some of his bills died. And he said, he sort of joked and said the speaker just never forgot that loss. And it was, it was one of those moments where, the minority party really sort of, came behind and showed that they also had a lot of respect for the speaker.
Yeah, of course, the speaker was himself a very gifted athlete. At one point, he was drafted by a professional football team, I guess the Dallas Cowboys. Josh Kurtz, talk about the different leadership styles between Mike Bush and Mike Miller, the president of the Senate. We call them lovingly the two Mikes. People talk about Mike Bush as the coach. I've heard people refer to Mike Miller as more like the godfather. How do you see the differences in their approach to legislating?
Well, it's funny because they do have that reputation. But actually, the House is three times as large as the Senate. And so in the Senate, when you're the presiding officer, you can give your members a certain amount of freedom. And Speaker Bush, really had to run the House with a lot of discipline, but he kind of did it in a very sort of nurturing way. He was a mentor to a lot of people. He was very inclusive. He made sure his leadership team was very diverse, and yet he still made the trains run on time and kind of, was always on top of everything. So, I think you could really write a book on those guys' leadership style, but, it's hard to see anyone kind of replicating what Bush did.
Yeah, and Rachel Bade, does Mike Bush automatically become the paradigm for the next speaker? Will the House be looking for somebody who has, do you think, the same kinds of qualities? Are they going to be able to replace Mike Bush with another person who's similar to Mike Bush, or people resigned to the fact that he was kind of a sui generis, singular character, and they might not be able to find somebody who's going to, succeed in the same way?
I don't know how you could come find someone who is exactly like Mike Bush. As Josh and Brian have said, he was his members affectionately called him Coach, and that was kind of his leadership style, was to coach and mentor people through. And while you may find a new speaker who also coaches and mentors people in their own way, I think you would find everyone has their own leadership style, and I think you'd be hard pressed to find someone who does things exactly the way Mike Bush does or did. The other thing about this is that he was speaker for 16 years. And so he wasn't necessarily the same speaker when he started as he was when he finished. And so he, I think in that sense alone, the world has changed in the last 16 years, and a new speaker is more likely to reflect kind of the realities of today's world and today's and the leadership in the legislature now.
Yeah, and Brian Sears, the relationship between Mike Miller and Mike Bush, as Rachel mentioned, Mike Bush been around for 16 years. Mr. Miller been around more than twice that amount of time, the longest serving Senate president in the United States. How did they get along? I mean, Mr. Miller was very very positive in his reflections on Mr. Bush yesterday, but as a practical matter and in real life, I mean, how did the two of them work together?
Look, I think they worked together well at times when they had to. They were also, these are also two men who, are leaders of their own respective bodies. They represent their body's respective perspectives on things, which are not always the same. Pretty good example is to take a look at, for example, how gaming was handled in the state of Maryland going back a decade. And the Senate president wanted to pass gaming with a straight up or down vote, and the only way to end up getting it done was the way that the speaker wanted to get it done, which was to ultimately write gaming into the state constitution. This has come up again as we talk about the legalization of recreational marijuana and the differences between the two houses. But at times they could work together. they sometimes joked about their relationships. There was a famous moment at a Democratic rally before session when Bob Ehrlich was governor, where there were some questions about how the two men would work together because they occasionally butted heads. And at one point, you know, Miller famously sort of said, you know, we're going to be so close that when Mike Bush eats the watermelon, I'm going to spit out the seeds. So they could, you know, they could work together, but, you know, they also had their, you know, they also had their moments where they parted ways on issues.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Our guest today, Josh Kurtz. He's the co-founder and editor of Maryland Matters. Brian Sears reports for the Daily Record, and Rachel Bay is the WYPR State House reporter. Josh Kurtz, people have been very careful to be respectful of the fact that the Bush family is, you know, dealing with this shock that just happened on Sunday. A funeral, as far as I understand, has not yet even been scheduled. But in terms of a successor to Mr. Bush, what's the next step? How does that, how does the House choose a successor? And do you have any sense, and you wrote a little bit about this today in Maryland Matters, do you have any sense of a schedule that we might see for such a vote?
Well, nothing's set in stone, but it's looking like this will probably happen in the next few weeks, possibly late April, early May. And a few things have to happen. Officially, this is a vote of the entire House to choose the new speaker. But effectively, and in most cases, it's really the choice of the Democratic caucus, because they have such a big majority in the state house. And so there are discussions going on. House leaders, Democratic caucus leaders yesterday were talking a lot to Attorney General Brian Frosch on his staff on sort of the process and how things need to work. But, you know, they really haven't figured anything out quite yet. And so, you know, both sort of the process and the actual jockeying are going to be ongoing stories for the next few weeks.
And Rachel Bay, the folks that they're talking about as possible successors, as a possible successor to Mr. Bush, Maggie McIntosh, a Democrat who represents Baltimore City, a legislator from Prince George's County, Derek Davis, who chairs the House Economic Matters Committee. That's the committee that Mike Bush started at before he became the speaker. People have talked about Speaker Pro Tem Adrian Jones, the Democrat from Baltimore County, and even House Majority Whip Talmadge Branch. How do you see this playing out? Are there clear favorites here? Is there somebody who is at this point already risen to the top as the likely successor? Do you think this will be a contentious process?
Truthfully, I don't know. I mean, this is a pretty closed door process for the most part. The Democratic caucus wants to keep these decisions and these deliberations fairly close to the vest. But it's, you know, each of these people that you've mentioned, they've all had fairly long tenures in the House and have made names for themselves in different ways. They're all very different people. One of the general consensus is that the next speaker will likely be a woman or a person of color, better represent the diversity of Maryland. But all of the people that you've named just now fit into that category.
Sure. And Brian Sears, in terms of how this works, are those people, Delegate McIntosh, Delegate Davis, Delegate Jones, Delegate Branch, are they actively campaigning? I mean, are they talking to their fellow legislators and saying, you know, I really want this job and I'd really like your support? Or is it, how's this done?
Well, in some cases, they already have been. Clearly, I think that, you know, Delegates McIntosh and Davis are probably ostensibly right now the front runners. And they've really been talking about lining up support going back 2 years right before the speaker had his liver transplant. And that was done at a time when there was some conversation about whether or not the speaker would be running for reelection, whether he would be returning. And they were doing this all with the speaker's blessing. And interestingly enough, all of them were very clear with me in interviews that they were not doing this in an attempt to supplant Bush, but merely setting up a line of succession and preparing for the, you know, in the event that the speaker made a decision to leave on his own. And so a lot of this groundwork has been done. The complication that you have now is that, you know, the speaker was sitting at the time of his death. He has not had a funeral yet. And this is, you know, and a lot of these folks who are in the mix were very close to the speaker. And so there's this, I think, for lack of a better term, almost a cooling off period where you probably won't see sort of the outright campaigning. You may see things that are a little more subtle, where members, you know, candidates are checking in with other members to see how they're doing, or, you know, on the last day of session, checking in with members to see how, you know, their bills are doing, or were things, you know, if did they have something that was hanging up that they really wanted to see passed that someone could help them with, which is not sort of the overt campaigning, but definitely the falls into the relationship building categories for later.
It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're talking about the Maryland General Assembly. Sine die was yesterday. The 439th session of the Maryland General Assembly is now in the history books. Josh Kurtz is the co-founder and editor of Maryland Matters. He joins us on the line from Annapolis. Brian Sears reports on Annapolis for the Daily Record. And Rachel Bay, she's here with me in the studio. She's WIPR's State House reporter. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll try to take some of your calls and questions. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's midday on money. As we prepare our taxes and take stock of our finances, what are the best strategies for managing the money we have now and investing for a future in which we are financially empowered? Nicholas Abrams is a certified financial planner and the founder and CEO of AJW Financial. Stuart Ritter is a CFP with T. Rowe Price. They'll take your questions and comments about financial literacy and how to manage your money tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about how the Maryland legislature has managed your money over the last 90 days. The 2019 General Assembly closed up shop for the season last night. It remains to be seen when the House will choose a new speaker following the death of Mike Bush on Sunday, and it remains to be seen how much longer Senate President Mike Miller will continue in office, given his very serious health challenges. He was diagnosed with metastatic prostate cancer some months ago. I'm joined today by Brian Sears of the Daily Record, Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters, and Rachel Bay of the WYPR news team. If you have a question for any of our panelists, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, and you can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Brian Sears, let me ask you about how the cloud of controversy hovering over Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh impacted the session this year. Yesterday, we had the House delegation from Baltimore City agreeing with the Baltimore City Council calling for Mayor Pugh to resign. I wonder, do you get the sense that with other legislators from outside the Baltimore area, was there a reputational hit to the city in this year's session, given this news that broke, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago?
Yeah, look, I think that it's impossible to look at city leadership now with the same eye that perhaps we went into the session with, and Catherine Pugh's ethical cloud, if you will, probably starts because of a bill that starts here in Annapolis, sponsored by city senator Jill Carter, who was looking at the concerns about self-dealing among members of the board that stemmed from what she said was a separate complaint by a business owner who had concerns about not being able to compete for certain contracts that were going to board members. And this then, you know, started to spiral out sometimes, as these things do, and the mayor gets caught up in it. And since then, one could make the case that this has not been sort of particularly handled well. I don't think down here the mayor's press conference before she took her leave of absence was received rather well. A lot of legislators expressed to me that it was a head scratching moment for them. They didn't feel like she had done herself any favors, and taking this leave of absence right at the same moment where the scrutiny is intensifying. Even if the health issues are legitimate, and she certainly is, you know, she certainly did not seem well during her press conference. It raises questions about the timing of it. And now you have members of the Baltimore City delegation who a week ago were not willing to call for Catherine Pugh to resign and were taking a wait-and-see approach and saying that she needed to be given time, to now coming out and saying that, you know, the best thing for Baltimore is for her to not come back and really raising questions. Delegate Cheryl Glenn said last night that there was some real concern that if the mayor came back that she might have to take another leave of absence. And the inference there was directly related to the, you know, what she referred to as, you know, the ongoing ethics questions and potentially some investigations that are looking into potential criminal matters, if there are any.
And of course, the mayor has not been charged with any crime. The mayor is being investigated by the state prosecutor, by the Board of Ethics and the Inspector General of the city, as well as the Maryland Insurance Commission. Josh Kurtz, what about the fact that Mike Bush also held a seat on the board of the University of Maryland Medical System? Mike Miller has a representative that represents him on that board. There were 9 people in total, including Mayor Pugh, who were found to have contracts with the UMMS. So she's by no means the only person who's involved in that kind of thing. Whether that's illegal is a legal point that who knows. But, you know, if it's unethical, certainly the legislation that Senator Carter and Senator Bush or Delegate Bush, Speaker Bush proposed was meant to address that. Are there going to be others in Annapolis who are going to be tainted by this University of Maryland Medical System controversy?
Well, I think you're going to see a newfound scrutiny on lots of state boards and commissions now, and who gets appointed to them, and their relationship with the entity, potential business relationship with the entity. Speaker Bush and President Miller were very quick to embrace this reform movement, and I believe it was President Miller who said, basically, you know, there's going to be more of this to come now.
By the way, Melody Simmons in the Baltimore Business Journal posted a story last night about another chapter in this continuing saga where the mayor was found to have approved nearly $20,000 in city funds to a nonprofit called the Maryland Center for Adult Training, which she serves on the board. There are several people who work on her staff at City Hall. They are also on the board, and she did not disclose in ethics forms the fact that she did play a significant role for some years now, more than 10 years, with the Maryland Center for Adult Training. The city had funded that particular nonprofit in prior years. Stephanie Rawlings Blake allocated some $56,000 to it. So it's not unusual that it would happen, but I think it's unusual that Mayor Pugh herself was on the board. So it's just yet another example of things that are possibly ethically challenged, as we might say. Let's talk about a couple of the bills. We have a caller, Spice, in Baltimore, who wants to talk about some of the environmental bills. Spice, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I'm going to put on my Sierra Club hat. I'm the chair of the Greater Baltimore Group of the Sierra Club, and I just want to send my condolences to the Bush family first. And I would like you all to talk about some of the bills, that the environmental bills that passed and some that didn't. The one on the pesticide that did not pass to ban a certain pesticide in Maryland, when we know that Roundup causes cancer now, and that we need to really look at what we're putting in our soil and in our water, and also the Clean Energy Jobs Act that passed.
Okay,
and I know that there was some controversy around the wheelabrator or the incinerator.
Yeah, well, thanks for that call, Spice. Rachel, the Clean Energy Jobs Act did, in fact, pass. What does that commit the state to do?
Yeah, so this bill requires the state to get 50% of its electricity from renewable sources by the year 2030. That's an increase from the previous similar law required the state to have 25% renewable energy by 2025. The controversy here... There were a few controversies, but the one the caller just mentioned is that trash incineration is classified as a tier one renewable. It gets a little in the weeds, but the basic gist of it is the state kind of incentivizes electric companies to purchase energy from tier one renewable sources as opposed to lower tiers or non-renewable sources. And so it's sort of seen as a subsidy of these. And by including trash incineration, which is something that some Republican members in particular tried to remove from the legislation, but were unsuccessful at removing, by including it, it supports that industry.
Yeah, and Josh or Brian, or either you have either of you paid close attention to the bill that didn't pass that would have banned toxic pesticides?
I mean, I could speak to it a little bit, Tom.
Sure.
And I guess, sort of what I would say, kind of, you know, a sort of more a global view about how things happen in Annapolis is that, you know, there are some bills that are going to get embraced eventually, but there's sometimes a reluctance to be seen as doing sort of too many quote-unquote big things at once, and I think that may have been the case with that bill as much as anything. Certainly there were some powerful forces lobbying against it, but I have a hard time seeing it not passing in the next few years.
Yeah, in other words, because the Clean Energy Jobs Act passed, which requires the state to go to 50% renewable energy by 2030, they didn't want to bite off more than they could chew in this particular go-around, so they put off the pesticide bill for another day.
Yeah, I think that's part of what was going on.
Yeah, and Brian Sears, the legislature did move to ban styrofoam. What kind of styrofoam, and what does that ban entail, and when does that go into effect?
Well, this one was one that was followed by a colleague of mine, so I probably am not the best one to speak to it. I think probably what I'll do is defer to one of my colleagues who may have covered it more than
Okay, that's fair enough. Rachel, I think you pay pretty close attention to this.
Sure, yeah. So this bill primarily bans the sale of food containers that are made of styrofoam. So that's takeout containers, cups, and plates. And it goes into effect, the law takes effect this July, but the ban takes effect the following July. The idea is it gives people a year to use up their current supply. Notably, it does not pertain to block styrofoam that comes in packaging when you buy electronics, for example. And kind of the idea behind this is that lighter weight styrofoam, the plates and the cups, and the takeout containers, they break down very easily. They're very lightweight. There's not really a market to recycle them, even if you have the technology to recycle them, which there was some discussion about in Annapolis. But as a result, it ends up often in the waterways, and fish eat it, and it really is a source of pollution more so than that kind of heavier block styrofoam is.
Rachel Bay covers the State House for the WIPR News Team. Josh Kurtz is the co-founder and editor of Maryland Matters. Brian Sears writes about what's going on at the State House in Annapolis for the Daily Record. It's midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. Let's go back to the phones to Barry in Baltimore. Barry, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My concern is about a bill that passed for Johns Hopkins to have their own private police department. I think that sets like a crazy precedent, because now, I mean, what's to stop Exelon or any other business entity in the city from saying we want our own private mercenary force?
Yeah.
And I'm still unclear on who they answer to.
All right. Thanks for that call, Brian. This was a very contentious issue in some quarters here in the city. The Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, the African American advocacy organization, devoted much of their attention to try to get this bill killed. They did not succeed. The bill passed, and I guess the bill passed pretty easily when all was said and done.
Yeah, and look, I think that there was a balancing act here between wanting to address some of the concerns about the police, about a private police force and accountability, while also attempting to address, the public safety needs of a campus like Hopkins, both the medical center and the university, which are very large presences in the city, and certainly it doesn't it shouldn't surprise anyone that this also happens at a time where, you know, the city is also the focus of concern because of, you know, because of violent crime. And so I think that there was a, you know, there was a balance there that legislators tried to strike, and they did try to put into the bill some accountability measures. Certainly not everything that everyone wanted, and some folks wanted nothing. Didn't want Hopkins to have an independent police force at all. But at this point, I think there was a lot of pressure to at least try to provide an additional measure of public safety in and around these campuses.
And Josh Kurtz, what about the caller's point? Barry says, you know, what's to stop private companies, Exelon or BGE, from having their own private police force? Was that part of the discussion when this bill was considered?
It was, and I think it was one of the most potent arguments that opponents made against the legislation. But I don't know that there's a good answer either, because you know, I guess that could happen down the line. You know, the caller did say this has never been tried before. It certainly has in other private urban college campuses around the country. But he's correct in that this is, I believe, the first private police force anywhere in Maryland.
And when it comes to criminal justice and violence reduction, Rachel Bay, there was a bill concerning background checks for gun sales known as the gun show loophole. What's that about, and how did that fare?
Yeah, this is a bill. It would have required background checks for all sales of long guns. So right now, if you buy a handgun, you have to have a background check. But if you buy a long gun and it's a private sale from, say, I own a rifle and I want to sell it secondhand, I don't have to right now have that buyer go through a background check. This would have required sellers to and buyers to kind of take that transaction to a licensed dealer to perform that background check. But there were some differences in the House and the Senate bills, and ultimately they couldn't work out those differences, so the bill didn't go anywhere.
Has anybody followed closely the fact that the bill concerning the control of the Baltimore City Police Department did not succeed? The city council was very, here in Baltimore, very intent on wresting control of the police from the state. The statute in the Maryland code that covers this dates back to the 19th century. They wanted to have more oversight and more complete control of the city police department. And interestingly enough, it was the Senate delegation from Baltimore that opposed it and sort of kicked the can down the road a little bit. I mean, Brian, were you following that one?
I actually was not. That went through, a committee that my colleague Steve Lash was covering, so it wasn't something that I followed carefully.
All right, Rachel, did you take a look at that?
I followed it kind of from a distance, but the basic gist of it is that the city delegation was concerned about liability issues. So if the idea was that, according to, I know Senator Bill Ferguson in particular raised some concerns that the bill didn't actually do what the advocates were saying it did, and that it would transfer liability for legal settlements, for example, to the city. So that right now, if someone sues the Baltimore City Police Department, the state is on the hook for some or all of that settlement, and this would transfer all of that liability to the city, which is something the Senate delegation in particular didn't want the city to have to bear.
And Brian, we got to take a break, but before we do, I do want to ask you about a bill concerning craft brewing. This had to do with how much beer you're allowed to sell if you own the brewery. That did pass. Tell us what that's about and what that effect will be.
Well, these are bills that actually go back a session, and bills that were initially sort of championed by the comptroller, but these are not the comptroller's bills. These were sponsored by individual legislators. The comptroller's bills never got reintroduced. But interestingly enough, they do a number of things, including eliminate a pesky buyback provision, which would force some craft brewers, once they hit a certain limit, to essentially sell their product to a distributor and then buy it back from the distributor so that they could sell it at their brewery. It creates larger caps. I think most of the brewers that are in Maryland are not at those caps, but it gives them room to expand if there is, if there's the possibility to expand. And it also eliminated a really troublesome franchise agreement, which essentially locks these craft brewers into relationships with distributors that they almost can't ever get out of, even when the marriages don't work so well. And so this essentially allows the brewers, based on how large they are and how much money the distributors have invested in promoting their product, to buy back to basically end these agreements in 45 days. And to buy back their products, either for the amount of the product that is sitting in a distributor's warehouse, or the cost of that product and the reasonable cost of whatever the distributor is paid in terms of promoting that brewery. And there are members of the craft brewing industry that say that these provisions are transformational for them.
Brian Sears covers the State House for the Daily Record. Josh Kurtz is the co-founder and editor of Maryland Matters. And Rachel Bay covers the State House for the WIPR News Team. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. We're going to take a quick break. We will have more on the 2019 General Assembly. On the other side, our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. Stay with us.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about what happened in this year's session of the Maryland General Assembly. The legislature introduced 2,497 bills over the last 90 days. Many of those bills never made it very far, but a chunk of them did. We're talking about them with Brian Sears of the Daily Record, Rachel Bay of WIPR, and Josh Kurtz of Maryland Matters. If you have a question for our panel, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org to drop us a tweet @MiddayWIPR, and you're welcome to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWIPR. Josh Kurtz, what about Larry Hogan, the governor? What was his imprint on this session?
That's a very interesting question, Tom, because I don't think he had much of one at all. And it's interesting because he seemed sort of distracted. His national profile got elevated considerably over the last few months as people started talking about, the possibility of him challenging Donald Trump in the Republican presidential primaries. He had a string of interviews with national media outlets that really, I think, helped his reputation nationally. But he just seemed quite disengaged. He came out with four vetoes pretty quickly. The legislature overrode all of them. It seemed to me that lawmakers were just going about their business without really thinking about him much at all.
And Brian Sears, the governor did propose a new map for the 6th Congressional District. This is the district that's the subject of a Supreme Court case that was argued a few weeks ago. What happened with that?
Literally nothing. There wasn't much that was going to happen with the new maps. The governor's proposal to redo the way we do redistricting and bring in and create an independent commission. But specifically on the issue of the 6th district, because that's the subject of litigation, it was pretty clear very early on, before the governor even completed the work of his task force that helped draw up the map, that lawmakers were not going to move on this. They have shown a historical hesitance to do anything in terms of legislation when there is when there are courts involved, and when the Supreme Court's involved. I think that raises the level of hesitancy here. And so I think really what everyone wants to do in the legislature is wait and see what the Supreme Court does, and whether or not they punt this, or whether or not they provide some kind of standard that becomes a national standard that then could require, if they come back with some standard or strike down the Maryland map, we could be back in a special session maybe later this summer.
And Rachel Bay, I guess there are a few things that the governor was pushing for that maybe didn't get passed as separate bills, but perhaps were incorporated into some of the other things that did get through.
Yeah, and the big one there would be the governor proposed an inspector general to handle what he called waste, fraud, and abuse in the school system. And the legislature actually ended up incorporating kind of a similar concept into a bill that passed that was based on recommendations out of the what's known as the Kerwin Commission. So they also proposed kind of an inspector general to help, as they put it, add some accountability to making sure that school systems implement the reforms they want to see.
And Josh Kurtz, can you explain what happened with the bill having to do with renovations to the Laurel racetrack and the Pimlico racetrack? This is a bill that failed, but it failed to the cheers of the Baltimore delegation. What was proposed and what happened with it ultimately?
Yeah, there was a lot of maneuvering. There were bills in to provide a lot of extra funding to improve Laurel Park racetrack, to make improvements at the Bowie training track, and this could have diminished Pimlico's stature, and Baltimore City and legislators fought it fiercely. They sort of simultaneously had a push going to try to, you know, increase a study and get more funding to improve Pimlico and the surrounding neighborhood. But, you know, nobody could really agree on anything. And I think from the city lawmakers' perspective, the status quo is better than nothing.
Yeah, I mean, we're assured that the Pimlico will be the home of the Preakness at least for this year and for next year after 2020. It's anybody's guess, I suppose. Brian Sears, when it comes to the state's handgun permit review board, the legislature's decided we don't need that anymore. They abolished the darn thing. What did it do, and why did they get rid of it?
Well, so the Handgun Permit Review Board is a five-member citizen board that is appointed by the governor. And essentially what they do is they take appeals on decisions made by the state police related to concealed carry permits. So it's important to note that the first thing is we're talking about people that already are licensed to be able to own a gun, who are then seeking a concealed carry permit. And in a lot of cases, the vast majority of these appeals, at least in the last year, related to modifications, restrictions that the state police put on it. Sometimes these restrictions, according to gun rights advocates, can be described as confusing to the point where it makes it difficult to even use the permit. And so the board has become sort of this focus of scrutiny because of the number of times in the last year, 225 times, I think, in the last year that they've changed the rulings to the state police. And again, like 75% of those were related to these restrictions. There was some concern among lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, that the wrong kinds of people, that their words, were getting these guns. And they wanted to eliminate the board and move these appeals in front of an administrative appeals judge, which is used by a lot of other review boards for other types of licenses. In the end, Bobby Zirkin, who chairs the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, he had helped craft a bill last year that made administrative law judges the next tier in appeals after going to the Handgun Permit Review Board. Taking the board out of the equation, he said, really doesn't sort of generate the kind of change that he thinks that opponents to the board were looking for. So in the end, he didn't think it was a big deal and helped work to get it passed. But it really ended up being a point of contention and another sticking point for Second Amendment rights advocates here in Maryland, who feel like the legislature is just constantly out to get them.
And Josh Kurtz, when it comes to regulatory authority, Peter Franchot had his plate denuded of some things that he heretofore has been in charge of, having to do with alcohol, tobacco, and gasoline. The governor vetoed a bill, but the legislature seemed pretty intent on making sure that some of that authority is taken away from the comptroller's office. What's that all about?
Well, the legislature and the comptroller have been at odds over a variety of things, some having to do with regulatory policy of alcohol in the state, some having to do with just pure politics. They basically just don't like each other. And this is now the second session in a row where the legislature has taken some authority away from the comptroller's office. Last year, they removed members of the Board of Public Works. They limited their say in school construction projects. And then this year, they took away the comptroller's ability to regulate alcohol and tobacco. Motor fuels was originally in the bill, too, but it got taken out. And it was a pretty ugly exercise, I got to say, on all sides. But, you know, power politics at its best or worst, depending on your perspective.
As a practical matter, is it gonna make a difference in terms of regulation of tobacco and alcohol? Tobacco, for example, another bill passed that was strongly supported by the Legislative Black Caucus to raise the age in which you're able to purchase tobacco to 21. But when it comes to regulating those industries, is it going to change things much, Josh? What do you think?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. The proponents of the legislation that passed envision the inspectors and investigators who work for the comptroller's office going to work for a new commission, new agency under the authority of the governor's office. The comptroller's office says it's not going to be that easy, and that any transition is going to be quite expensive. So it kind of remains to be seen.
And Rachel, in the healthcare arena, a drug affordability board was a bill establishing that was passed. What does that do? And I guess when the bill in the House and the bill in the Senate on this issue started, they were pretty far apart, but they did find a way to meet in the middle.
Yeah. So this is a bill that creates what they call a prescription drug affordability board. And its primary role is to, for the next couple of years, kind of look at the industry and try to come up with ways to reduce prescription drug costs. Eventually, and this was part of the compromise, they delayed this part of the bill a little bit, but eventually the board will have the authority to say to pharmaceutical companies for drugs of a certain price, Marylanders are not going to pay above this cap, this amount on your drug. So you can charge whatever you want, but this is how much they're going to pay. And that was a part that the pharmaceutical industry very heavily fought, as you might imagine. But ultimately, the Senate actually stripped out of the bill initially, but they were able to come to a compromise and include.
And Brian Sears, when it comes to education funding, the Kerwin Commission calls for spending a whole lot of money, some $4 billion over the next 10 years. They got a head start in this session. What did they pass?
Yeah, we got sort of a first bite at the down payment. We're looking at, I think, roughly about $355 million coming up in the next fiscal budget that starts in July. A lot of that money is going to end up going to pre-K and to teacher salaries, which with an incentive to local governments, if local governments will raise their teacher salaries by 3%, the state will kick in another 1.5%. There's also some money that's meant to go towards creating community schools in high poverty areas. And then we look at another $370 million in the following year. And then on top of that, if the legislature can find a way to fund it, they'll bump that by another 130. One of the pots that they're looking at is the money that will come from the online sales tax, both from taxing large companies that do business in Maryland, like, you know, that have places in Maryland like Amazon and Apple, but also looking at individual sellers who might use Amazon or eBay or Etsy who are selling into Maryland who reach these Supreme Court levels thresholds of number of transactions or dollar amount sales in Maryland to also pay sales tax. And so if Maryland surpasses $100 million in online sales, the overage above $100 million would go towards funding education.
And Brian, I'm sorry, we're gonna have to leave it there. We are out of time, but I very much appreciate all of you, Brian Sears, Rachel Bay, and Josh Kurtz, for fantastic reporting through this session. And we look forward to talking to you again very soon. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, what does it mean to be financially literate? What do we need to know about the changes to the tax code as we file our taxes for this year? And what do we do to become financially empowered? We're going to be joined by Stuart Ritter of T. Rowe Price and Nicholas Abrams of AJW Financial for Midday on Money. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recognized by the Daily Meal. Menu and hours at Joe Squared. Here and Now is coming up next. It's right after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.